Welcome to a brand new edition of Problematic Women. I'm Kristen Eichhammer, and today I'm in charge. So I brought two dear friends onto the show. Our returning friend, senior legal fellow Sarah Parshall Perry, and new friend, Project 2025 senior program manager Kaylin Stumpf. Thanks for being on the show, guys.
I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. I thought we could open with something we all shared in common, which is we all actually served in the Trump administration in totally different areas.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was NASA's in their comms shop and in the CFO office. But Sarah, I know you were pretty big.
I was senior counsel at the Office for Civil Rights at Department of Education. And ironically, that kind of ties into one of the things we're going to be talking about today, which is women's sports and Title IX. But I loved working with other really smart attorneys who had both served in public positions and who had been in private practice, and all of them had really deep experience in civil rights. But it's just nice to be with people who interpret the law as the law should be interpreted, by the plain letter of the law, without reading any political influence into it, which is kind of what we see happening right now from the Department of Education on their Title IX rule.
Mm. And Kaylin, you were at the big house, right?
That sounds like it's jail, but yes, I was at the White House in an office called the Presidential Personnel Office, and we oversaw the hiring and vetting of political appointees across the executive branch. So if you were going to get hired at an agency, we often had our fingers involved somehow. So it was a great time, and I got to learn a little bit about a lot of topics and agencies, but I'm no expert like Sarah.
Oh, no, it's very deep, but it's also very short.
Yeah. I mean, you also got invited to the Christmas parties, but what I wanted to just, you know, take a second to do is plug our Project 2025. If you haven't checked it out, I know I've talked about it. Kaylin here is helping to run the effort. Do you guys have a website or any resources you can point our listeners to?
Yes, I would encourage all listeners to go to Project 2025.org. The best thing to do would be to sign up to be in our presidential personnel database if you're interested in potentially serving in a conservative government, a conservative presidential administration one day. You can go there, get educated by reading our Mandate for Leadership. It's a 900-page book that over 400 authors came together and wrote last year to talk about what conservative success looks like at every agency. So if you're out there and you want to get involved, go to project2025.org. We need more people. We need people from outside D.C. who are passionate citizens, patriots, who want to serve. So
awesome. Thank you. Surrounded by some awesome role model women. But anywho, on today's episode, we are highlighting some of the recent fights focused on protecting women's sports. Wait until you hear who's getting involved. Plus, Sarah is shedding some light and breaking down the recent Supreme Court-held oral arguments on disinformation and the federal government's role. And finally, Gold Star Father disrupted the State of the Union, and that was a few weeks back. But that story continues. We're going to break down some of that breaking news from last night that sheds a light on how this story has progressed. And as always, we'll be crowning our Problematic Women of the Week.
Each week on Problematic Women, we sort through the news to find stories that are of particular interest to conservative-leaning or problematic women, those whose views and opinions are often excluded by those on the so-called feminist left.
If you are a problematic woman or just someone who supports strong, independent women, please consider supporting us by leaving a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and encouraging others to subscribe. It really does make a difference.
All right, let's get to it.
Alrighty. So, again, I'm in charge, so we're talking about sports today. And I know Sarah and Kaylin both have thoughts on this particular issue, but there's been a lot going on in the last few weeks. Riley Gaines actually was joined with a few former and current athletes and filed a lawsuit against the NCAA for allowing male athletes to compete in women's sports. So in addition to, you know, getting your bracket in place for that tournament that's going on,
yeah.
NCAA is also dealing with this.
Yes.
But that lawsuit aims at changing some of the NCAA's policies, allowing male athletes who identify as transgender to participate in women's sports. And they argue this policy comprises the fairness and integrity of women's competitive sports and discriminates against women. Sarah, I know you have a lot to say this case in particular.
Yes. So, in fact, she is the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit that you just mentioned. And they've actually brought the claim under Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, exactly what I was tasked with enforcing, one of the many civil rights laws at the Department of Education. It's been around for 51 years. It's always protected women in athletic opportunities. Equality in education is really its guarantee. It's been doing that without interruption until the current presidential administration. And the Biden administration's interpretation is, listen, sex also means gender identity. Well, we know, because we believe in immutable truth, that you are born either male or female, and people are not born into a wrong body. This is largely a psychological condition. It is not a physical condition. So she's actually brought this suit with other athletes, as you said, under Title IX, because the NCAA is an indirect recipient of federal funding. Title IX's rules are, listen, if you are a direct or an indirect recipient of federal funding, you are subject to Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, which is very short, very simple. It simply prohibits sex discrimination in federally funded education programs. That's it. So they've brought this claim under the NCAA, against the NCAA, against for a violation of Title IX. And essentially, these are all women who are in a bunch of different sports. And the NCAA has basically thrown their hands up and said, you know what, you guys can all manage your sports the way you want. And swimming can take one route and basketball can take another route. And in the end, it's created this patchwork that leaves women athletes with this inability to predict where they can actually go to play a sport that is not essentially interfered with by biological men. And listen, we know the NCAA ranking system is a huge moneymaker. So the NCAA recognizes this outsized power they have to be able to thumbs up or thumbs down a ranking, D1, 2, or 3. And really, this is something I think that has to be stopped, because they carry too much pressure against the universities who may otherwise want to keep sports separated by sex, as Title IX really commands.
Yeah, and to your point, there's been so much, just like sports are going in so many different directions. And one that has been really under our radar, at least, especially with Riley Gaines, is swimming. Caitlin, I know you swam in high school and your sister actually competed in college. It was D1, mm-hmm. correct? Yeah. Can you, I just want your thoughts on just, you know, this case and just it in general, honestly.
So, yes, I come from a swimming family. I was born and raised in Florida, and I have three siblings, and all of us swim. I was the only one that did not swim Division I. I was a social swimmer, they would call it. But my sister was really good. She went to Dartmouth. She won the Ivy League Championships in 2019 in the 100 breaststroke. She holds two records at Dartmouth. Her name is on the board, and she actually went to the Olympic trials in 2016.
Wow.
When she was 17.
Casual.
Yeah.
Casual swimmer.
Yes. So very good. And I say all that to just say that I have some exposure to this sport, of course, and how much work goes into being an elite swimmer. Riley Gaines, you know, and I guess the other part of it is how much work women put in, any athlete puts in, to be at the top of their game. And then how, I guess, vulnerable women are when they're swimmers, because they're definitely, I would say, you know, a space where men should not be, women's locker rooms. And that to me is always, I guess, the second half of the craziness with this story. I've seen some of Riley Gaines' recent interviews. She just did a Joe Rogan podcast where she spoke for 3 hours. And the fact that a fully male person was allowed just 2 years ago to walk around the women's restroom and then also compete against them when he's, you know, 6'4" and he was competing.
Fully naked, yep.
Like, it's almost too gauche to talk about, but, you know, these women were walking around with, you know, a man who was naked. And that happened because the NCAA was weak and the coaches were weak and the officials were weak. And these women were subjected to, I think, sexual harassment. But under the Biden administration, I guess it's
normalized.
He's a woman,
yeah,
which is just insane. I believe I don't know if this is, I think it's accurate, day one EO that came out from the Biden
yes.
administration.
January 21st, 2021. It was, you know, Merry Christmas, guys. You know, here's a little New Year's present for you. That was one of his official acts, first acts as president, was that executive order. And it instructed all federal agencies. Now, I want you to think about all the regulations and federal laws that these agencies are tasked with enforcing. Said to every one of them, you are to interpret sex to include gender identity. Well, that touches 100 laws and mm-hmm. regulations. So you can see how this is manifested. Housing, healthcare, education. I mean, it really has, it's been a trickle-down effect. We know how much the administration has been making new rules, right? We talk a little bit about the administrative state. That is because they are churning and burning on trying to run these things into the Federal Register with these expansive sex definitions so that when the administration changes hands, and we're hoping it's when, not if, there is now this brand new cemented interpretation of gender identity under the umbrella of biological sex. Well, that puts women at an automatic disadvantage in multiple aspects of life.
So, to your point, how do we see this lawsuit combating some of that? Because, I mean, it's an executive order. It's changing a ton of laws. What is this, in your opinion, going to do?
Well, you know what this is now is sort of a clash of the titans, because you have a number of Title IX lawsuits in the federal courts, but then you have the federal government at the executive level basically saying, no, this is the interpretation we've chosen to do. And so what these individuals who are suing are tasked with proving, and this is happening all over the country, they have to prove that the reliance from the administration on a particular case, and those of you who listen to PW have heard me reference this before, called Bostock versus Clayton County, means that sex and gender identity are the same. Here's a spoiler alert. They're not. And in fact, that opinion actually began with Justice Gorsuch writing, we begin with the understanding that sex means male and female. That's a sentence I don't think the Biden administration likes very much.
They probably flag it.
That's exactly it. And they absolutely gloss right over it and go right to the end holding, which was, if you fire somebody for being gay or transgender, are you firing them on the basis of sex as prohibited by Title VII of the Civil Rights Act? Now, here's what that means. Title VII specifically requires zero consideration of sex. The court said, all right, if you're looking at somebody cross-dressing or you're looking at somebody's homosexual behavior, you're automatically taking into account their sex. That's the underlying basis. Why? Because we look at their attitudes and behaviors. Now, I think he got a little over his skis in this, and there were a lot of other legal scholars who believe that he focused too much on the literal meaning of sex and that the ordinary meaning of sex in 1964, because we know the drafters of the Civil Rights Act weren't thinking sex and gender identity mm-hmm. were the same thing. He focused on what people do as male and female, as opposed to who they are as male and female. But that ultimately requires step one, are you a man or a woman? If you're a woman and you date men, it's great. If you're a man and you date men, well, we're going to fire you. Gorsuch said, no way. So the Biden administration has taken that tiny little holding, very limited, and specifically the court talked about, we're not talking about bathrooms, dress codes, pronouns, sports, anything of the kind. Mm-hmm. Again, the Biden administration just, whoop, we just completely ignore that. That doesn't help our cause whatsoever.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no. And someone who's not actually, you know, just taking it and letting it go over their head, surprisingly, in my opinion, maybe not surprising to others, is Caitlyn Jenner, who headed to Nassau County, New York, to support County Executive Bruce Blakeman's recent executive order banning biological males from competing in women's sports at county facilities. I think this is pretty, I don't know, I don't have the right word, but just like a mic drop moment, honestly,
yeah.
him as the county executive saying, my county facilities, they're totally available. But if you have men and women sports, nuh-uh. And
yeah.
I just think that Caitlyn Jenner then flew out and totally supported him. She actually said, she was, you know, referring to all of this and was like, we have to do this before it's too late. We're doing it now. We're separating women's sports, protecting women's sports before 15 years from now when it's just a totally different looking
yeah.
sport altogether.
Yeah, and let me tell you what happened with the county executive. This is actually somebody who I think is exhibiting a lot of courage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the attorney general in the state of New York is uber far left, Letitia James. And he, County Executive Blakeman, issued an executive order, right? So this is government at the level closest to the people. He issued an executive order saying to play in any of our park facilities, to get a permit, you have to separate your sex by male, female, or co-ed.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can't get a permit to play. Well, that's about 100 facilities in Nassau County, New York. A lot of sports teams, a lot of intramural sports teams use those facilities. Well, I think that was a lot of courageous, you know, sort of demonstration on his part. But within literally a few days, he got a cease and desist from Attorney General Letitia James's office saying, this is illegal under Bostock. It's against the laws of the state of New York, blah, blah, blah. So Caitlyn Jenner makes a point of showing up and saying just what you said, Kristen, that it is incredibly problematic and that male-bodied athletes and female-bodied athletes have different abilities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is somebody who competed as an Olympian.
Won twice a gold medal.
Right, right, according to his biological sex,
mm-hmm.
which is male.
Yeah.
I think in the deep recesses of Caitlyn Jenner's mind, and I'm using air quotes here, that individual realizes they are still biologically male.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, why stand the line and really refuse to back down on the notion of the differences in female and male bodies?
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes that males have faster muscle twitch response, bigger bone density, broader shoulders, better oxygen uptake. I mean, the differences are incredibly specific and widespread between men and women. And, you know, kudos to County Executive Blakeman for
yeah.
saying, listen, I know the Attorney General is going to come after me, but this is my county. We're going to protect girls on these fields.
Not really sure how, you know, that AG has the time to even micromanage this, but
she has a few other things on her plate, frankly.
A few other things. But I did also, I found out Blakeman actually has kids, and I don't think James, the AG actually does. So who do we really think cares about those kids, you
yeah.
know, like the kids and those people playing these sports? Because at the end of the day, you know, I would rather have someone making laws that is actually going to be impacted by those, because I know they're going to make the best decisions.
Yeah.
And Jenner had 6 biological children and 4 former stepchildren. So
yeah.
it's a whole brood
yeah.
there.
Which side are these people on with the kids?
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think this person sounds like a really reasonable dad.
Yeah. Girl dad.
Is, you know, a lot of this is stuff that my dad would say. So I can't imagine why I think that.
Yeah. No, literally, as a swimmer and with a sister.
Well, because he's the dad.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He sounds
no.
so reasonable and logical here.
Yeah. Who knew? Who knew? But anywho, we're going to pivot in a second to the SCOTUS story from Sarah. Sarah's going to break it down for us, actually. But before we do, the Network of Enlightened Women sees the challenges that conservative women are up against on their college campuses. From liberal professors to finding friends on campus, it can be a lonely place for these students. That is what inspired News President Karen Lips to write You're Not Alone, The Conservative Women's Guide to College. Readers will get to know more than 20 college students and alums as they share their real stories and advice in this book. With these stories, Lips identifies problems on campus and provides practical tips on how conservative young women can thrive in this environment. This college guide covers the many struggles and real-life situations that college women will face, whether they are a freshman or seniors. Empowering these women will help them become more effective advocates for conservative ideas during and after college. You're not alone. The Conservative Women's Guide to College is available now for purchase on Amazon. Buy a copy today for yourself, your daughter, your granddaughter, or, you know, your, I think I bought one for my sister, actually, or anyone who wants to know what is happening on campuses today and is in search of conservative community. To learn more about the Network of Enlightened Women and the Conservative Women's Guide to College, visit their website at enlightenedwomen.org. Okay, so Sarah, we've got a Supreme Court case. You know, they had their oral arguments yesterday. That, honestly, you just break it down for us.
Yeah, so this is a huge case. Remember, it's not the first social media case that we've heard this year. Of course, there were a pair of net choice cases, and those were coming out of the states. And in the two net choice cases, just so we can kind of compare one to the other, they concerned state rather than federal efforts to prevent censorship by the federal government. And these were legislative actions, right? So Florida, Texas passed very sort of narrowly tailored bills to be able to protect individuals within their states from being censored on social media platforms. However, Murthy versus Missouri, this is the federal government using back channels between White House officials and social media executives to suppress views, even factually sound views, because they run against the government's narrative. These were essentially back channel communications, and it's not the first time things like this have happened. The government, unfortunately, in many respects, has interests that they argue are prevailing over, for example, free speech concerns. If, for example, there's a national security threat. This instance specifically involved both election interference and the COVID-19 pandemic. And two of the plaintiffs here were actually doctors who really sort of came to national prominence because they were calling into question whether or not the national lockdown response and the vaccine response were actually not only medically sound, but called for administratively. Well, the Biden administration didn't like that. Here's the unfortunate outcome. What we heard essentially from the Supreme Court yesterday is contrary to what I think the district court and the Fifth Circuit out of Texas both found, in which they both discovered, yes, this is a pretty damning attack against free speech. In fact, the district court judge, remember, this is the trial court judge, he called it the most massive attack against free speech in U.S. history and absolutely enjoined top to bottom the executive branch agencies from communicating with the platforms. Fifth Circuit on appeal basically narrowed that injunction a little bit, but also affirmed that by threats and encouragement and back channel communications, the executive branch had co-opted the social media platform's content moderation process. That made the Fifth Circuit very uncomfortable. I think some of us anticipated we would see the same response from this particular Supreme Court composition, who have been very strong on free speech. That was actually not the case, with the exception of some questioning from Justices Thomas and Alito. We definitely saw the majority of these justices lean toward content moderation and encouragement from the federal government to say, we don't think this is in the best national interest. The linchpin was whether or not their efforts were coercive. That seemed to be, for a lot of the justices, something that they focused on as being sort of the crux of the entire issue, not simply the First Amendment issue itself. And Justice Jackson specifically said, this is something that is hamstringing the government. Your view of the First Amendment is hamstringing the government from censoring perspectives that it has a national need to censor. And I think a lot of conservative, you know, jurists and legal scholars were screaming, that's the point, yeah, right? It's the First Amendment, stupid, yeah. Yeah. Right? I mean, we want to make sure that what is tantamount to the virtual public square is open, it is accessible, it is as free as possible. And by maintaining that First Amendment standard, We can allow perspectives, even perspectives we don't like, even statements about a vaccine that at the time the Biden administration was pushing as the holy grail of the COVID response, and which, P.S. now, we know did very little good and a lot of harm. It is now one of those situations that we heard yesterday as being sort of inclined toward the suppression of free speech. If the government can make a legitimate argument that it has a need to shut certain people down, that's, I think, discouraging.
For sure. And I mean, Caitlin, would love your thoughts on this. I know you don't necessarily have a Twitter, but like you definitely, between her and I feel like we send memes to each other twice a day at least.
No, interestingly, I have a brother who was working at Twitter in 2022 when it was bought by Elon Musk. So I've had a little bit of intel into the back side of things. But I think my takeaway from this is just the collusion that I would call it collusion that happened between Facebook officials, some Twitter officials, and the White House, which is, you know, recorded in emails where they were reporting back the number of accounts they were banning, the number of pages they called. They had during COVID times.
Is that what we're calling it? COVID times?
There was a disinfo dozen where there were 12 super problematic accounts, according to the Biden administration, that were bucking the narrative on the COVID response and vaccine and restrictions, and really just Americans, including Dr. Bhattacharya, a Stanford medical doctor. They were just basically speaking the truth, at least from their perspective. But the administration did not like that. And they wrote emails to these companies saying, you know, what can you do about this? And these companies would report back saying, we took it down. And that doesn't feel very free. That feels like a violation of the First Amendment, in my opinion. But I guess the bigger takeaway is I'm very grateful for the purchasing of it by Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. I don't think if we had gone back a couple years, we would have ever thought that things on Twitter could get better. Or there was a way out of this censorship. So that was a huge moment for free speech. And yeah, I think we're better for it. Yeah.
And it's interesting that this has come and there are these opinions that are being voiced after that purchase by Elon. You know, like it's become a platform where things can be freely expressed. There's not as many, I mean, there still are some warnings, but there's not as many things being taken down. There's not as many banned accounts, banned tweets, whatever. It's super interesting. I cannot get over that comment, though, of this is hamstringing the government. I know it's a little, you need some more context to fully understand it. And they're arguing that, you know, if there is war times and someone was, you know, putting information that would jeopardize war efforts, like what about that? Or what if they share an elected official's address and say, let's go riot here? And my thought to that is, why aren't we paying attention then more to TikTok and how they're mobilizing users and just, you know, causing all of these threats to the elected officials and just Americans in general? Why aren't we focused on that then?
Well, and you know what? Again, this is just sort of textbook First Amendment law that, yes, speech is protected, but there are certain categories of speech that are not, right? So fraud is not protected. Child pornography is not protected. Obscenity is not protected. Fighting words are not protected. Incitement to commit violence. These are things, if we just follow that First Amendment standard and we treat this as the public square, right? Because it is essentially where everyone gets their information now. If we use that standard First Amendment law analysis, it really would do us so much good. And we would have a system to be able to sort of push all of the content through. There's already a grid for this under the First Amendment. And I'm encouraged by the fact that Elon Musk has openly represented that he is anti-censorship. He seems very sort of doubtful of the collusive efforts of the federal government. And Twitter is, X, I should say, is a much more open and accepting platform of views of all kinds. Mm-hmm. That is, listen, we have a mute and block button for a reason, right? If you don't like it, you don't have to listen to it. So, yeah, I'm discouraged by what I heard during oral arguments. But again, the counter to that is that we see at least one of the major social media giants really taking a stand against censorship. Now, obviously, TikTok is a problem. Instagram and Facebook are continual problems. There are other options for that. There is the Communications Decency Act. We could look at that again. There are antitrust laws that would sort of break up the monopoly that they have on social media. But long story short, as concerns oral arguments yesterday, I would not be holding your breath that the government gets away scot-free on this, or the government doesn't get away, I should say, scot-free on this, because it sounds like all of the justices, even the conservative and the moderate ones, seems to be inclined toward letting the government use back channels to really encourage posts to be taken down.
And just last thing on this, where are we going from here? So they had their oral arguments on it, not looking super great, but next steps.
So at this point, the term ends at the end of June. We have seen a real thin trickle of occasional orders and opinions, but nothing substantial. And remember, we have oral arguments coming up just a couple of days on the abortion pill case. Mm-hmm. We have four gender identity cases still pending to be considered on the 22nd. These are going to take up medicine bans, gender, quote, affirming care bans for minors under the age of 18 coming out of Kentucky and Tennessee. So these are very big cases. Still a lot of controversial stuff in the hopper that the Supreme Court hasn't even thumbs up or down in terms of whether it will review. So we don't know when we will see this, but because of the impact, my guess is it will probably not be released until closer to the end of the term, which is probably sometime in May or June.
Wow. Well, thanks, Sarah. That was great. I learned a lot. Now, we're going to go ahead and shift gears. We are covering a breaking story now. It actually came out, I think it was Tuesday night, on the State of the Union. And one of the guests actually invited, it was a Gold Star father who was arrested for yelling during Biden's address. Steve Nakui is the name of this Gold Star father, and he was taken into custody by Capitol Police after disrupting the address, yelling, "Remember Abby Gate and 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines," from where he sat. And for those of you who maybe haven't connected the dots yet, he was referring to the withdrawal from Afghanistan. His son, Kareem Nakui, tragically died as a result of an ISIS-K suicide bomber. We obviously got those reports, and I still remember where I was sitting when that all happened. It was absolutely heartbreaking. But this father attended the State of the Union. He was the guest of a Florida Republican Representative Brian Mast, and you know, he yelled, he was asked to stop, and he didn't. He continued, and then basically he was grabbed from underneath his armpits, it sounds like, and just carried away, handcuffed out, and held until 1 a.m. in the morning, which I was thinking about this. You know, there's so much crazy crime. Our colleagues, you know, Collie Stimson and a lot of people in the Mace Center have kind of pointed to all of the increases in crime, and I'm not even sure that they hold real true criminals that are caught breaking in, carjacking, etc. for that long. So
yeah.
Not sure if I'm off base, but there is a lot to say about this story. Caitlin actually highlighted it for me, but what are your initial thoughts?
Well, my initial thoughts are that he went on, Steve Nakui went on Hannity after the show, and he talked about what inspired him to do this. He wasn't, I don't think, planning on doing this, according to him, but President Biden had mentioned Lake and Riley by name after being, I think, goaded into doing that by Marjorie Taylor Greene yelling out about her. But he said on Hannity, "The poor Riley family, they're killing my kid, they're killing your kid, and what are you doing, America? Are you going to wait until they kill your kid?" So that's a pretty intense statement, but this is a man who lost his son, and I think it can be, you know, at least heavily placed at the feet of the Biden administration, the Department of Defense, how that botched withdrawal happened. It didn't have to happen that way, and Americans suffered because of it. And then to not have your son's sacrifice recognized or to feel like it is just overlooked is just a pain I don't know, you know.
Yeah, he's actually said and made a statement saying, "I waited 3 years, paid $3,000, and traveled 3,000 miles to finally hear my name's son in the State of the Union." And I mean, you're a mom, Sarah.
Oh, my gosh. Thoughts? You know, his anger is entirely justified. This administration has never taken full responsibility for the nightmare that was the Afghanistan withdrawal. I mean, I have seen so much footage of the airport attack at Abbey Gate, 170 Afghani civilians killed, our civilian people held up at the American embassy being held hostage by ISIS, 13 American service members killed. I remember seeing the footage of the Afghanis running after the plane it was pulling out, desperate to try to get their kids on the plane and get their kids evacuated. And I just totally understand, as a mother, what it would be like to look at the nation's commander-in-chief who has not taken responsibility for the death of your son and being unable to control myself from blurting something out when he's in a position to say something about it and take responsibility. That would be hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I could see myself doing that. I don't even have kids. But this is, as a reminder, the same president that checked his watch several times when those 13 Marines that were killed due to his leadership were brought back to Dover, Delaware. It's absolutely astounding that there has not been anything said. And like to your point, Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of did, it seems, pressured. Mm-hmm. What I found most interesting, if you kind of look back at the moment and you watch Biden with Kamala and we've got Speaker Johnson, behind him, Rep Johnson is trying not to like grin or maybe even be like, right on, you got this. He's
right.
Holding his tongue. You can see his like lips moving and his face kind of twitching because he's trying not to say anything.
But the very slightest of eye rolls is what I saw.
But everyone in that room, I think, maybe not everyone, but at least most people on our side of the aisle were absolutely foot stomping because that man, Steve McNicoe, totally in the right.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the American people also are aware of the gravity of the withdrawal and how bad it was because President Biden's approval numbers have never recovered since the high that they were at prior to that. So this happened in August of 2021, and he's never been able to recover post that. So the American people know that was, you know, just a total black mark in our history, an embarrassment to end our presence in Afghanistan after 20 years in that way was just terrible. And I think the second part of the story was with Steve McCoy was he was arrested. And I think the State of the Union happened several weeks ago at this point, and the DOJ was holding him on charges, or they were going to charge him Tuesday, March 19th. So it took them several weeks to decide if they were going to charge him with this misdemeanor. Thankfully, it was only a misdemeanor of disrupting. But, you know, I think they gave into the optics, really. I think they realized, okay, there's enough backlash about arresting a Gold Star father on a misdemeanor. Maybe not charge him. Thanks, Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
I think he thought through that. Even he could, like, see the political assessment of that. And he was like, all right, that one doesn't pass the muster.
Yeah.
Dang. Yeah. And I really fast just wanted to go over some of the defense news and just world news since that day. Obviously, I saw a report kind of along with this, and it said Biden has proceeded over a record-breaking 11 embassy evacuations. He has his botched Afghanistan withdrawal. Since then, Russia invaded Ukraine. They discharged Marine for criticizing leadership on, I believe it was the Afghanistan withdrawal. And then, you know, North Korea has declared itself a nuclear weapon state. Hamas launched that surprise attack on Israel.
Keeps going.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more bullet points. I don't think, you know, China's in the South China Sea flexing on everyone with their warships. Haiti, I'm still not totally sure what's going on, but
yeah,
the cannibals.
Let's not forget October 7th.
Oh, well, I said Hamas invaded Israel for those who, yeah.
Sorry.
But yeah, don't worry, though. They did launch an Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
So many to remember.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
That's okay. We have, you know, our higher up military leadership parading around in high heels for, you know, sort of.
Never looked better. Just
priorities.
For Pride Month. So, you know, that, listen, the entire goal of a military force is combat lethality.
You
want them to be, yes, not under this administration. You want them to be ready to go to war and to be able to defend the sovereign interests of a nation. And we have not seen this level of international debacle in probably the better part of 30, 35 years. We were a superpower, a military, legitimate military superpower under the previous administration. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people took issue sort of with Trump's personality, the way that he represented himself. But on the international stage, boy, I tell you what, he had everyone from Angela Merkel to, you know, Xi Jinping basically saying, this is not a man to be messed with. That makes Americans feel safe.
Yep.
Guess what? You get an individual who doesn't take that kind of a strong approach toward international leadership and defense readiness. Well, and then we have the history you just rattled off.
Yeah. It's absolutely insane how we've 180'd, literally.
We need to pray for this country and vote for, you know, maybe different leadership.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, we've got some time. And good news is we're crowning our Problematic Women of the Week next. So yeah, stay tuned.
Americans use firearms to defend themselves between 500,000 and 2 million times every year. But God forbid that my mother is ever faced with a scenario where she has to stop a threat to her life. But if she is, I hope politicians protected by professional armed security didn't strip her of the right to use the firearm she can handle most competently.
To watch the rest of Heritage expert Amy Swearer's testimony on assault weapons before the House Judiciary Committee, head to the Heritage Foundation YouTube channel. There you'll find talks, events, and documentaries backed with the reputation of the nation's most broadly supported public policy research institute. Start watching now at heritage.org/YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe and share.
Now, it's that time of the week, my favorite time of the week, time to crown our Problematic Woman of the Week. And the crown goes to
Melissa Oden. Now, if you guys don't know who Melissa Oden is, she has an incredible story as an abortion survivor. She was born in 1977. She actually survived a saline abortion, which is how many of the abortions were done back in the 70s, soaked in solution, listen to this, for 5 days. To the point that they had to induce her 19-year-old mother to go into labor. So literally, you want to talk about the hand of God intervening in a situation like this? They injected her with saline. She was literally floating in what was designed to kill her, did not get expelled. She was induced into labor, finally came out alive, I'm quite sure, to the shock of all of the individuals in that particular room. And she sat down with one of the reporters at the Daily Signal, Mary Margaret Olihan, saying that, you know, they induced her mother due to her life being at risk. But she said, you know, this is one of those stubborn facts that abortionists don't like to talk about, right? So abortion is ending a child's life, and it puts the woman's life at risk as well. Why? Because abortion is never without risk. It is actually safer to deliver a baby through the natural pregnancy process than it is to perform an abortion, because the risks of intrauterine hemorrhage or uterine perforation are so great. Sepsis, I mean, the list goes on and on. And that's not even what is associated with the abortion pill, which is now accounting for 50% of American abortions. And some studies say now it's up to 63% of American abortions. Again, thank you, Biden administration. Now women can use the abortion pill up to 10 weeks. So it is truly safer to go through childbirth than to actually have an abortion in the United States. But this is one of those Hobson's choice where we don't hear from the administration that to save one life, you have to kill another, right? And this is part of her distinct story. And it's fascinating to me that she has just been given this incredible platform and this miraculous life to be able to speak about this from the perspective of one who was intimately affected by it.
It's absolutely insane. And yeah, to your point, what a story.
What a courageous woman.
What a courageous woman. And my whole thing is every procedure in that I've ever undergone, they are so crazy detailed with all of the risks and all of the potentials. I had knee surgery and they're like, you might die. And I'm like, oh my goodness, what?
You're like, I don't need my knee that
bad. I don't
need
to walk anymore. And I just don't feel like they shed the same light with abortion, because it's all about, you know, a narrative. So
that's exactly it. Why would you talk about the dangers of abortion? Because you want abortion to be, quote, safe, legal, and rare. Oh, wait, that's what we were saying 30 years ago.
Oh, man. Well, way to go, Melissa. And if you haven't checked out that news story, it's on the Daily Signal's website. Mary Margaret Olihan, great reporter here, really does a beautiful job just sharing Melissa's story. So that's going to be it for this week's Problematic Women.
Join us next Thursday morning for a brand new edition. And in the meantime, please subscribe and share.
Conservatives need your support in the podcast world, and we would greatly appreciate a 5-star review on Spotify, CastBox, Apple Podcasts, all the podcast apps, or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does make a difference.
See ya.
Problematic Women is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation.
It is a product of The Daily Signal, produced by Lauren Evans and Virginia Allen. And be sure to follow Problematic Women on Instagram.
We produce Problematic Women in remembrance of our dear friend and former co-host, Bree Payton.